It wasn't like a weight had been lifted from his shoulders or anything like that. The weight was still there, and probably always would be. But it wasn't like life hadn't already heaped plenty of burdens on Sherman Branch either. And he thought he felt a little better as he walked away from the Silver Bell. At least he had tried to do something. Then, a dark shape stepped out from an alley mouth in front of him.
I told Cole you'd go run into that bunch in there. I told him it would stick in your craw so bad you'd have to do something about it.
What?
We needed a signal to get things started. I reckon this'll do as good as any.
The slug hit Branch square in the chest and knocked him backward. He sat down on the edge of the boardwalk and tried to draw a breath into his body past the giant surge of pain that seemed to fill him. It was no use. There was nothing left of him except the hurting and a last fleeting thought of his wife. Then he toppled backward into blackness.
Everybody down! Blow out the lamp!
Matt crouched and drew his guns. He kicked over a table to serve as cover from the constant barrage of bullets. A few feet away, Sam was on his feet with his revolver in hand. He knelt behind an overturned table, too, as did Judge Ashmore and Casey McClennan. Matt cast a glance toward the bar and saw that Charity and the other men had disappeared. They were down behind the hardwood, which was about the safest place they could be right now. As he watched, Charity stood up long enough to blow out the lamps at each end of the bar. As she puffed at the flame in the second one, she suddenly fell out of sight.
Charity, are you hit?
I'm all right. A bullet just came right by my ear and scared me.
Anybody else hurt over there?
We're all fine.
Matt looked up. The lamps on one of the silver chandeliers were still burning, casting enough light around the room so that the bastards outside could see to aim their shots. He hated to do it, but he tilted up the barrel of his left-hand gun. Darkness fell over the saloon, relieved intermittently by muzzle flashes from outside.
We were lucky no one was hit in that opening volley, but we're in a bad spot anyway, pinned down like this.
I know. Cole's probably got men posted behind the place just in case anybody tries to get out that way.
Is the door locked back there?
Locked and barred. I took care of that earlier. We couldn't be too sure that Cole would make his move this soon, but Matt and I figured we needed to be ready in case he did.
That's why there are Winchesters and six guns and plenty of ammunition under the bar.
You ladies feel free to help yourselves over there.
We're already ahead of you. If those bastards get in here, they'll find a hot reception waiting for them.
Speaking of hot receptions, what if they try to burn us out?
Not likely to happen. Cole can make use of this building if he gets his hands on it. Bullet holes can be patched and window glass can be replaced, but the place is lost if it's burned down. Besides, in the middle of town like this, if you set a fire, you risk it spreading to the rest of the settlement. More than one whole town has gotten burned to the ground like that.
So what you're telling us is that they'll sit out there and keep shooting until they've picked us all off.
That's about the size of it.
That's what they plan to do anyway. What they don't know is that Matt and I have a different idea.
What's that?
Matt grinned savagely in the darkness that now cloaked the saloon.
We're gonna take the fight to them.
Bo, Scratch, and Hector weren't very far from the outskirts of town when the shooting started. As they reined in, Scratch frowned at his companions.
Sounds like a war going on up yonder.
Damn it. Cole must be going after Bodine and Two Wolves already. I was hoping we'd get there first so we could give them a hand.
I reckon we still can. They probably got those young Hellions pinned down somewhere. They won't be expecting trouble from some other direction.
Probably right about that. Hector, you sure you're up to this?
Just lead me to the battle, Senor Bo.
Scratch grinned and slapped him on the shoulder.
You're a good hombre, Hector.
Let's go.
They rode on toward Buffalo Flat, halting and dismounting when they reached the edge of the settlement. They tied their horses in a little clump of trees and started forward on foot, clutching their Winchesters. Bo saw orange stabs of muzzle flame up ahead on the right side of the street. A few shots flared in return from the left side of the street, where the Silver Bell was located. To a man who had seen more than his share of trouble, the muzzle flashes told the story quite plainly. A smaller force was holed up inside the saloon, while the larger attacking force had found cover in buildings across the street and behind parked wagons and water troughs and rain barrels.
We can circle around and get behind them. We'll come up that alley next to the building where some of them are taking cover. From the mouth of the alley, we'll have a good angle on the ones behind the wagons and watering troughs.
And we can cut down some of them before they even know what hit them.
The three men began working their way alongside one of the buildings. When they reached the rear corner, Bo stepped around it first, only to find himself facing several shadowy figures. Starlight glinted on gun barrels. Bo flung himself forward, hitting the dirt as bullets sizzled through the air above his head. His Colt was in his hand and spouting flame before he hit the ground. One of the men staggered backward. The others lowered their aim and kept firing. Bo rolled desperately to the side as slugs pounded into the ground where he had been lying just a heartbeat earlier. That distraction gave Scratch and Hector a chance to duck around the corner and open up with their rifles. The Winchesters spat death and sent the gunmen tumbling off their feet. Bo scrambled up as the last of the shadowy figures fell. They were all down and unmoving, he saw. He holstered his gun and fished a match from his pocket. Snapping the Lucifer to life on his thumbnail, he held it up and let the wavering glow from the flame wash over the fallen men. He recognized them as four of Porter Wood's gunslingers. None of them was Ike Davis, and Bo was grateful for that, even though he was well aware that they might have to swap lead with Ike before the night was over. He shook the match out and dropped it at his feet.
Come on, fellas.
When they reached the alley, the three men started along it toward the street, moving silently through the darkness. Suddenly, Bo heard two men dropping to the ground behind them. Even as he whirled around with his gun in his hand, Scratch turned too, but Bo had the sick feeling that both of them were going to be too late to meet this unexpected threat.
Wait! Don't shoot!
Two wolves? Bodine?
Creel? Is that you and Morton?
And Hector Ibanez from the Half Moon. You fellas were right all along about Mrs. Kincaid. Somebody tried to ambush us while we were on our way out to the ranch, and I reckon she was probably behind it.
So we rode back here to give you a hand if Cole tried to wipe you out tonight. From the sounds of all that shooting, that's what's going on here.
You're right. We made it out of the Silver Bell, but the others are still pinned down there.
We're trying to improve the odds some.
We whittled out of my mind ourselves. There's four of Cole's men back up the alley who ain't gonna bother you no more.
Then between us, I think the odds are far more in our favor. 16-13.
We can handle that. And when we're done,
then we'll deal with Cole and Terry.
The Colorado Palace had cleared out. None of the townspeople wanted to sit around drinking or gambling tonight. They all wanted to be home with their heads down, hoping that stray bullets would steer clear of them and their families. That left Cole, Teresa, Anna Malone, Porter Wood, Lucas Tate, and Ike Davis in the saloon. Wood, Tate, and Ike had stayed to protect Cole and Teresa on the slim chance that Bodine and Two Wolves might survive the attack on the Silver Bell and come looking for revenge. That possibility was so remote that it was laughable, Cole thought. But at the same time, he didn't mind having three tough, fast guns around just in case. He sat at one of the tables with Teresa while Anna stood at the bar throwing back shots of whiskey. Cole had enjoyed the time he'd spent with Anna, and she had been a dependable partner in his schemes for a long while. But he sensed that in Teresa Kincaid, he had finally met a woman worthy of him.
Tell me, what really happened to your husband?
He was ambushed, shot in the back. Haven't you heard the story? Most of the people in Buffalo Flat seem to think that you ordered him killed.
They may think that, but it's not true. I didn't have a damn thing to do with his death, although I thought at the time it was a stroke of luck for me. It was a stroke of luck for you, for sure. You inherited a fine ranch.
As well as a lot of trouble.
Well, the Half Moon is worth some trouble. I know you found Kincaid's body. I'm wondering if you found him a little earlier than what you claimed. Like when he was still alive and never suspected that his loving wife would shoot him in the back.
Teresa just smiled and didn't say anything. Cole knew the truth, though. He could look in her eyes and know who had really pulled the trigger, ending William Kincaid's life. As he poured drinks for both of them, he told himself that he would never make the mistake Kincaid had. He would never give Teresa the chance to get rid of him that way.
To us.
To us.
At the bar, Anna Malone threw back another shot of whiskey. Matt, Sam, Bo, Scratch, and Hector quickly hatched a plan. The five of them would split up and close in on Cole's men from behind.
When we're ready, we'll call out and then take them on.
Why not just shoot them before we warn them?
Can't do that. Wouldn't be honorable.
Honor can sometimes get a man killed.
Yes, but unfortunately I agree with Mr. Creel. What about you, Matt?
As long as we ventilate those skunks, I don't much care how we go about it.
All right then, it's settled. Good luck to us all.
They moved apart from each other in the darkness, slipping around the buildings and through alleys until they were in position behind the gunman hidden along the street, who continued to pour lead into the Silver Bell. Matt hoped no one inside the saloon had been hit, but he knew the odds were against that, considering the volume of fire that had been directed toward it tonight. Soon, though, this fight would be over. He stepped onto the boardwalk a few yards from a covered wagon parked in front of a building. Two of Cole's gunslingers crouched behind the wagon, one at each end, and they were blazing away at the Silver Bell.
Hey!
At the other corner of the building, Sam Two Wolves stepped out of the darkness.
Drop your guns!
The two men hiding behind the water trough rolled over and lunged upright. Sam flung himself down on the boardwalk, wincing as slugs tore splinters from the planks and stung his face. He triggered his Colts. Farther along the street, Bo Creel strode confidently along the boardwalk. Two of Cole's gunslingers jerked around to face him. One of the gunmen was driven off his feet by a slug, but the other triggered two fast shots. A bullet slammed into Bo's left arm, jerking him around. He fought off the wave of shock and pain that went through him and put a slug cleanly through the second man's head. Not too far away, Scratch joined the fight, both hands filled with roaring pistols as he closed in on three of the gun wolves. Hector Abinez was beside him, and the rifle in his hands cracked again and again. Hector went down, his right leg shot out from under him. By then, though, he had blown a hole through one of the gunmen. Scratch accounted for the other two, hammering them with slugs until they went down. He walked over to the sprawled bodies, kicked them to make sure they were dead, then hurried back to kneel beside Hector.
You all right, compadre?
My leg hurts like El Diablo himself, but I will be fine. What about you and the others?
Matt, Sam, and Bo came along the street, regrouping around Scratch and Hector.
We all appear to be fine.
Speak for yourself. I caught a slug in my left arm.
Scratch came to his feet and over to Bo, a worried frown wrinkling his face.
How bad is it?
It's not my gun arm. That's what counts.
Sam and I checked the other bodies. Looks like the Silver Bell ladies got some as well. They're all dead. But Cole and Wood and Tate weren't among them.
What about Ike Davis?
The old-timer who wears buckskins. I didn't see him. Could be he's still down at the Colorado Palace with the others.
And that's where we're headed now. We still have to deal with Cole and Terry. How about you fellas go over to the Silver Bell and check on the folks over there? Let them know this part of the fight is over.
Scratch looked like he wanted to argue, but after a second, he nodded curtly.
Bo and Hector need some patching up, and Hector can't even walk. Bo, get on one side of him with your good arm, and I'll get on the other side.
Working together, the Texans lifted Hector and half carried him toward the Silver Bell, where Charity, Judge Ashmore, and Casey McLennan had emerged from the saloon, pushing the bullet-riddled doors aside to step out onto the boardwalk. Matt and Sam finished reloading their guns.
You ready?
Damn straight. Let's finish this.
Cole began to worry as the fighting down the street grew more intense. The shooting should have been over by now, he told himself. How long could such a motley force hold out?
You've crossed paths with Bodine and Two Wolves before. Is there any chance they might be able to get out of this?
Her expression had grown more worried as the minutes went by, too.
I wouldn't put anything past those two. I've seen them fight off long odds before.
I think you better go upstairs, just to be on the safe side. Take Anna with you.
I don't like being told to go and hide.
Cole reached under his coat and brought out a small pistol. He checked the loads in the cylinder and then placed the gun on the table in front of him.
I don't want to have to worry about either of you if there's any shooting down here. When Bodine and Two Wolves are dead, I'll let you know.
Teresa still didn't like the idea, but she nodded in agreement. She stood up and went over to the bar to join Anna.
Junia says we need to go upstairs.
Anna appeared to be drunk. She stared at Teresa for a moment, as if she didn't understand what the blonde woman had said, but then she nodded and started toward the staircase, stumbling a little as she did so. Teresa glanced at Cole one more time and then followed her. Teresa's hand tightened on the banister for a second. She didn't know what the silence meant. Hopefully, that all their enemies were dead. Cole picked up his gun and walked to the bar to join Wood, Tate, and Ike Davis. Wood had a drink in front of him.
Reckon it's done. The boys will be along in a minute to tell us that Bodine and Two Wolves are dead.
They damn well better be.
Matt Bodine and Sam Two Wolves stepped into the saloon. Porter Wood and Lucas Tate looked to Matt like they wanted to slap leather, but Cole put out a hand to stop them.
My men!
They're all dead.
That's impossible!
They wouldn't be here if it wasn't true, son of a bitch. I wouldn't have thought anybody could do that either.
You have a choice, Cole. You can keep fighting, or you can surrender and wait for some real law to get here from the capital. Either way, you're through in Buffalo Flat.
Cole struggled to get words past the rage and disbelief that clogged his throat. But Ike Davis didn't have a similar problem.
I'm through, that's for damn sure. I'm running out, fellas. This ain't my fight anymore.
The hell it's not! You take a step toward the door and I'll ventilate you myself, Ike.
Sorry, Porter. You done bit off more than you can chew.
Ike started toward the door. He spun after only a step, though, his hand darting toward the butt of his gun. He had to have known that Wood would carry through on his threat, and he was trying to beat him to the draw. Ike was fast, but not fast enough. The bullet slammed into Ike's midsection, doubling him over. He had his gun out, though, and got a shot off as he went down. Wood was rocked back against the bar by the impact of the lead.
Get them!
Cole jerked up his gun and fired at Matt and Sam. The Blood Brothers lunged apart as Cole's bullet whipped through the air between them, both men drawing guns as they dodged. Matt went for Lucas Tate. Tate staggered, blood pouring down his shirt. He slewed sideways, managed to get off one more round that went harmlessly into the floor, and then folded up into a bloody heap. Porter Wood was wounded, but managed to get off a shot. Matt felt the bullet tear through the crown of his hat. That left Sam to deal with Cole.
Can't end this way.
I reckon it can end this way. I reckon it has.
And yet, even as he spoke, Matt knew it hadn't, because Terry Kelly was still somewhere here in the saloon. Matt and Sam looked up sharply. She stood at the top of the stairs, a gun in her hand. Matt fought down the impulse to fire at her because he saw that even though she held the weapon, her arm was down at her side. She swayed a little. Her face was pale and drawn. Then, she dropped the gun. Matt and Sam watched in shocked surprise as Terry Kelly collapsed and rolled all the way down the stairs. When she reached the bottom, she sprawled on her face. The handle of a knife stuck up from the back of her shirt. The blade was buried in her back, in the center of a rapidly spreading bloodstain. Matt reached her and carefully rolled her onto her side while she still clung to life.
Bodine, I'm sorry.
Sorry for all the trouble you caused?
I'm sorry I didn't get to kill you before that bitch stabbed me in the...
She stiffened and her eyes began to grow glassy. She was gone, but she had been filled with hatred to the end. Across the saloon, Sam knelt next to Ike Davis, who looked up at him, blinking pain-filled eyes.
Tell Scratch, so long. Tell him I forgive him for Rosita.
I will. I'll tell him that you did the right thing at the end, too.
Much obliged.
Ike's head fell back as he died. Sam rose to his feet. He looked over at Matt and saw that his blood brother had stood up, too, and was gazing down at Teresa's lifeless body.
What happened to her?
I reckon that gal who was Cole's favorite before she came along decided to settle the grudge permanent-like. I'll have a look around for her.
Matt drew his gun and went upstairs. A few minutes later, though, he returned to report there was no sign of Anna Malone. The woman had fled. With any luck, they would never see her again. Bowen Scratch strode in, followed by Judge Ashmore, Casey McLennan, and several other townsmen. All of them were bristling with guns. Bo had his coat off and his wounded arm was bandaged. He glanced around the now quiet room.
Looks like it's over for real now.
Yeah. It's over and done with.
Sheriff Branch's body was found on the boardwalk near the Silver Bell. He had been killed by a single gunshot. There was the question of what would happen to the Colorado Palace, the Diamond Sea, and the Half Moon now that both Junius Cole and Teresa Kincaid were dead. Judge Ashmore would get the job of sorting out that legal mess, which was just fine with Matt. He had no head for such things, nor any stake in how it turned out. In fact, now that it looked like Charity and her friends were going to be running the best and most successful saloon in Buffalo Flat, there was no real reason for Matt and Sam to hang around. The same was true for Bo and Scratch. The wound in Bo's arm was a clean one, having missed the bone, and it would probably heal with no problem. The same was true of Hector's injuries. Judge Ashmore suggested that as soon as Hector was on his feet again, he should be installed as a temporary foreman of the Half Moon, since he knew the ranch and its operation better than anyone else still alive. The hands who had been left on the Diamond Sea, who weren't really gunmen, were running that spread for the time being, since Roy Barlow and the rest of the men had died during the big shootout in Buffalo Flat. The Undertaker had been mighty busy for a few days. After attending Ike Davis's funeral, Bo and Scratch went back to the Silver Bell and had a drink with Matt and Sam. Charity and the other women bustled happily around the saloon. A couple of them had been wounded slightly during the fighting, but they were already up and around again. As the four men sat at a table, Scratch glanced at Matt and Sam.
Well, where are you boys headed next?
We don't rightly know.
Generally, we just go where the wind leads us.
That's a good way to be. Scratch and I have been following that trail for a lot of years now.
You mean we're going to wind up like you two old pelicans?
And what in blazes is wrong with that?
Not a thing, old-timer. Not a blessed thing.
They raised their mugs of beer, clinked them together, and drank. Despite their friendliness, Matt and Sam sort of sneaked out of Buffalo Flat later that afternoon, heading north toward Wyoming. They worried that Bo and Scratch might want to ride along with them if they gave them a chance to do so.
I've got a hunch that trouble follows those dang Texans wherever they go.
And we sure don't want that. Now do we?
Matt grinned at Sam, and the two men urged their horses into a fast lope to follow the wind.
Blood Bond, The Hanging Road is a graphic audio production. Copyright 1992, William W. Johnstone. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2008, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Thomas Penny, Dylan Lynch, James Lewis, Sonny Lasky, Ariane Parker, Andy Clements, Terrence Aselford, Michael John Casey, David Coyne, Eric Messner, James Konacek, Ken Jackson, Richard Rowan, Karen Carbone, M.B. Van Dorn, Nanette Savard, and Mort Shelby. Directed by Nanette Savard. Book adapted for graphic audio by Cheryl Hayes. Dialogue editing by Temeskin Wubna, Nathaniel Perry, and Johan Detweiler. Graphic audio sound design by Johan Detweiler. Additional original music by Johan Detweiler. produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed Blood Bond, be sure to look for the first Mountain Man series, available at Road Stops Everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220, or at www.graphicaudio.net. And read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com. Keep listening for the next episode of Mark Dalton, Owner Operator.
Graphic Audio presents Mark Dalton, Owner Operator. Book number 2, Reefer Madness and More Tales of the Open Road by Ido Van Belkom. Copyright 2008, Ido Van Belkom. Performed by David Coyne and the Graphic Audio Players. Episode number 2, Stealing Home.
That'll bring up Jeff Johns, number 5.
Mark didn't have to pick up a load until 10 the next morning, so he ordered himself another beer. On the big screen on the far wall at Turtle Jack's, the Toronto Blue Jays were struggling with the Boston Red Sox, down 3-0 in the sixth with a starting pitcher who was lucky he could still find the catcher's mitt. His beer arrived at the end of the inning with the Jays down 4-0. But the frosted cold one delivered by the pretty smiling waitress wasn't the only thing arriving at his table.
Hey, I know you.
Mark stared at the man who had just sat down for a few moments. He looked familiar, but Mark couldn't quite place him.
Sorry, I don't remember you. It's me, Randy Reynolds. We were both driving for Bison Brothers a few years back.
Well, that might be true. Before Mark had ventured out entirely on his own, he had driven for Bison Brothers for a few weeks. But that had been several years ago, and how this guy, this Randy Reynolds, remembered him was nothing short of amazing.
Oh, yeah, hi. How's it going? Working hard?
Mark had been working hard of late, and with the beers flowing, he didn't mind letting this guy know all about his good fortune.
Well, you bet I'm working hard. Starting tomorrow, I've got a string of loads that's taken me across the country with a 2-day layover in Vancouver. And when I get back, I've got a ticket to the Jays game against the Yankees.
Mark gestured at the television as if he could see the seat on the giant screen.
First base, 3 rows up. What kind of loads?
Randy had the beer in his hand now. But judging by the way he was holding the bottle, he must have been nursing the thing for the past few hours.
I'm not sure. Got the list in my truck. But my dispatcher assured me it was all high-end, no-touch merchandise. You know, electronics and stuff like that.
That's cool.
What about you? How you doing these days?
Nah, crappy. My old lady's coming down hard on me these last few days. When are you gonna get a load? The magazines are full of ads for drivers. What are you waiting for?
Mark just looked at the guy, not sure what his problem was.
What are you waiting for?
Well, I don't have a truck, for one.
Lots of companies out there, plenty.
Let's just say my abstract's not the cleanest on record at the ministry.
Not all companies do extensive background checks.
Yeah, I'd have to find one of them companies now, wouldn't I?
A few phone calls probably do the trick.
Yeah, sounds like a lot of work to me.
That's why they call it that. You know, work.
Yeah, but then I'd have to be at home using the phone, and the damn woman would be hanging over my shoulder asking, "What'd he say? Did you take the job? When do you start?" You know, her name's Mary. She likes to think of herself as Queen Mary, but I know her as Bloody Mary.
What a lost cause, thought Mark. What man didn't have women trouble every once in a while? And if you had a valid driver's license, there were always plenty of places hiring these days. Mark decided to give up trying to convince the guy there was work out there and made peace with him by simply agreeing to whatever he said.
Gee, sounds like you got it rough.
Man, you don't know the half of it.
The guy kept talking, rambling on and on and on, but Mark wasn't listening anymore. He was too caught up in the game to care. On the screen, there were two out with Blue Jays on first and third. The score 4-0 in the Red Sox favor. The Jays looked to be ready to gamble. The runner on first was taking a big lead, as was the runner on third. Either one of them could have been caught by a quick throw from the pitcher, but the Red Sox seemed intent on having the Jays batter hit a ground ball or strike out trying.
Of course, she's got a sister whose husband is a garbage man for the city. You know how much those guys make in a year? My old lady knows, and she likes to remind me of it all the freaking time.
Randy stopped talking then, and Mark felt like he was supposed to say something to the guy, but he didn't want to take his eyes off the game or encourage him to say any more. And then the Jays' runners were on the move. They were trying to steal home.
I'm going to the can.
Yeah, sure.
Mark waved Randy away without taking his eyes off the screen. The runner slid into home just as the ball crossed the plate, and the umpire gestured safe, and the Sox catcher turned around in circles looking for the ball. It had gone all the way to the backstop. The runner from first was rounding third. He was being waved home. The catcher threw the ball to the pitcher covering home. The throw was high, sailing out past the mound and all the way to the second baseman. The second runner scored, safe. The Blue Jays now trailed 4-2, and the momentum of the game had definitely swung in their favor. Mark took a sip of his beer and then took a look around. Randy was gone. He'd said something about the washroom, but that had been a while ago. Maybe he'd moved off and was bothering someone else in the joint now. That was fine by Mark. The Jays were rallying, and it was going to be a great finish. When the game went into extra innings, tied 4-4, Mark ordered himself another beer. What the hell?
Hello?
Mark, what the hell is going on?
What do you mean? The game's going into extra innings.
No, not that. Why are you driving like a maniac?
What are you talking about?
I just got a call from someone complaining about the way you're driving.
It's not me. I'm sitting here at Turtle Jack's watching the Jays game.
Well, then, someone is out on the 401, following a Peterbilt that's going back and forth across the lane. On the back of the truck is a sticker that says, "How's my driving? Call 1-800.
It's not me.
They said the name on the back of the truck was Motherlode.
Must be a mistake. I've seen trucks like mine with names like Brother Road, Break the Code, and Driving Mode.
Would you do me a favor? Just take a look outside and see if your truck's there, will you?
Mark got up from his seat and realized he didn't hear the familiar jingle of keys he usually heard when he stood up. He put a hand to his belt loop and discovered his keychain wasn't there.
Oh, no.
Mark ran out of Turtle Jack's and into the parking lot. Motherlode was gone. His home, his life, everything he had in the world had been stolen.
Mark! Mark, are you there?
Mark slowly lifted his cell phone to his ear.
It's gone, bud.
Mark hung up on Bud and dialed the number for the Ontario Provincial Police, the police agency that had jurisdiction over Highway 401. He wanted to report Motherlode stolen. Wanted to tell someone the truck was on the 401 right now, and they could catch the thief if they dispatched an officer right now. But things weren't moving as quickly as he'd hoped.
Oh, please.
But...
For 5 long minutes, Mark stared at the empty space where Motherlode used to be parked.
Come on, come on.
Hello, this is Constable Hadley speaking. You wanted to report a stolen vehicle?
Yes.
Just let me say, sir, things will go a lot smoother for you if you just take it easy and keep your voice down.
My truck was just stolen.
Make?
It's a Peterbilt 379. It's on the 401 right now.
Year?
1985, but what's that got to do with
it? Where was it stolen from?
I'm here at Turtle Jack's in Brampton. It was stolen from the parking lot by a guy
named...
That's right.
Then maybe you should be reporting this to the Peel Regional Police. I think I have their number. Hold on.
Oh, God damn it!
Mark held his cell phone away from his ear and blinked at it several times. The officer had put him on hold. Again.
He's getting away, damn it!
Here's their number. 905-23...
Listen, the guy who stole my truck is eastbound on the 401 right now, and he's driving like a crazy man.
How do you know that?
Because some citizen noticed the truck driving erratically and called the 1-800 number on the truck to tell my dispatcher that one of his drivers was going to get somebody killed.
And you're not driving the truck at the moment?
Exactly.
And what's this citizen doing now?
I don't know. I think he's still on the phone with my dispatcher, following the truck.
We don't approve of citizens taking the law into their own hands.
Then send the damn cruiser out onto the highway right now and stop him.
All right. Where is he exactly? And what's the truck look like?
Mark gave the officer the information he needed, doing his best to stay calm, which was almost impossible under the circumstances.
Is that it?
What more do you need?
Just checking. We'll dispatch someone if there isn't already an officer out on the highway.
Thank you. I'll be waiting at this number for your call.
Thank you.
thanks.
Mark looked up at the screen. The Jays had lost to the Red Sox 7-4.
Damn it.
The OPP officer, Constable Hadley, called back an hour later to tell Mark that their officers didn't see any truck on the 401 matching the description he'd given them.
He must have gotten off the highway before we could dispatch our officers.
You think?
Mark didn't give a damn if the officer was offended by his tone of voice. If he'd acted more quickly, there would have been an excellent chance to catch Randy Reynolds red-handed. Mark could have picked up his truck, none the worse for wear, and still have been able to make his first pickup in the morning. Now, he didn't know what the hell he was gonna do.
You're going to have to make a statement to the Peel police on the truck.
But I already told you it was stolen.
True, but since it was stolen in Brampton, you'll have to file a report with them as well, you know, for insurance purposes.
Mark ran his fingers through his hair. Driving a truck was a tough enough job as it was. He needed this extra hassle like he needed a spoon at a steakhouse.
All right, I'll file a report.
And give them this occurrence number, so we can cross-reference reports if we have to.
Fine.
You know, there's a good chance we'll find your truck in a few days in some shipping yard. Usually there's not a lot of damage in cases like this.
Damage?
Motherlode was Mark's life. The thought of her being returned to him damaged in some way, or broken, well, it made him sick to his stomach.
Is there anything else you want to tell me? Anything else you can think of?
The Peel Regional Police Officer, Constable D'Amore, was an attractive young woman, probably no more than a year or two on the job. She seemed sorry for Mark's situation, but she was doing a good job keeping neutral on the subject.
Just that my entire life revolves around that truck.
Oh, what do you do? Live out of your truck or something?
Mark wondered if telling her the truth would help intensify the search for Motherlode. He didn't think so, and gave her a half-truth instead.
Just about, officer.
The young officer's smile became strained.
Well, we'll make sure other police forces in the GTA are aware of the theft, and with any luck, your vehicle will probably turn up in a day or two.
With not too much damage, right?
That's right.
The officer turned away like she suddenly had other things to do. Mark had walked out of the station, finding himself on Highway 10 across from the provincial courthouse. He could call another cab, this one to take him to a hotel for the night. But he decided to walk for a bit. Walk and think. He headed south for the new Best Western Admiral Hotel that had recently been built on Highway 10 between Brampton and Mississauga. It had been built to cater to business trade in and around the industrial area there. But so far, it hadn't caught on with the truckers, even with a major warehouse facility just down the street. As Mark walked, his thoughts kept revolving around a single question. What would somebody like Randy Reynolds do with a stolen truck? He could sell it, but getting rid of a tractor wasn't easy, especially when it was so personalized the way Motherlode was. It could be stripped for parts, but that took tools and a place to do business from. Neither of which Mark imagined Randy Reynolds had. He could take on the load and deliver it, but the guy wasn't doing that under the best of circumstances. It was unlikely he'd do that with a stolen truck.
Stolen!
The word echoed in Mark's head as if it were screamed at him through a tunnel. If he'd already stolen a truck, then why the hell not steal the load too? It wouldn't have to be delivered, and if it was a good load of consumer products, selling items out of the back of a trailer could be done just about anywhere. But what load?
Damn.
And that's when Mark felt his knees go weak as he realized it was his own damn fault, all of it. If he hadn't been so full of himself in the bar and talking about all the great loads he had lined up, then maybe Randy wouldn't have gotten it into his head to steal Motherlode in the first place. But if he hadn't told Randy about the loads, then he might not have had a chance to get his truck back from the guy in the morning.
All right, Reynolds. I'm coming for you now.
Mark was behind the wheel of a rented Ford by 8:30 the next morning. His pickup wasn't scheduled for 10, so he had plenty of time to get to the warehouse in Mississauga so he could wait for Randy Reynolds to show up for the load. Bud had filled him in on the details of his first few loads, and they were big scores from a thief's point of view. The first load was stereos and DVD players headed for a retail distribution center in Barrie. From there, he was supposed to pick up a load of mixed freight from a warehouse across town destined for a department store in North Bay. Then he was supposed to take a stack of flatbed trailers back to Calgary, where he would pick up a load of cowboy hats and leather chaps that were on their way to Japan through the port of Vancouver. And it all began in Mississauga with a couple $1 million worth of electronics. Mark turned off Highway 10 onto Matheson Boulevard and headed east nearly three major streets, General Road. He pulled into the lot outside the warehouse at the corner of General Road and Amco Boulevard and checked his watch. It was just after 9. Mark decided to wait for Randy to show up so he could say hello to the man before the police were called in. As he waited, he thought of all the ways he'd like to say hello. A fist in the mouth would be one way. Or maybe a kick in the nuts with a steel-toed boot.
Oh, that's a good one.
Or maybe just a few broken fingers and a warning never to touch Motherlode again.
That's what you deserve, you slimy bastard.
At least that way, Randy would have a legitimate excuse for not working. By stealing Motherlode, Randy Reynolds would end up with a valid reason not to be working. But if that was the case, why stop at his fingers? By the time Mark glanced at his watch again, it was after 10. He'd been watching the clock closing, but something about doing some serious damage to Randy Reynolds had made time fly.
Who the hell is this guy? Figures he'd be a damn lazy thief as well.
Mark waited until 10:15 before he got out of the car and walked over to the loading docks. He climbed the stairs, opened the door, and found himself just outside the shipper's office. There was a man at the desk inside the office reading the paper, and the rest of the warehouse looked like it was on break. Not like they were expecting someone to be picking up a load in the next few minutes.
Yeah?
Hi, I'm looking for a friend of mine. He was supposed to be picking up a load of stereos and stuff this morning, and I was going to be riding with him, you know, sharing the driving duties all the way out to the West Coast.
And he was already here.
What?
I'm pretty sure of it. The guy was here before 8. We weren't even open yet.
The man began looking through the paperwork on his desk.
Yeah, here it is. The guy's name was Mark Dalton. That your friend?
No, I'm Mark Dalton.
He had all the right paperwork.
I bet he did.
There's a problem?
Yeah, I think so.
Mark was tied up at the warehouse for another hour, doing his best to cooperate with the police, but wanting to get out of there as fast as he could. If Reynolds stashed the first load somewhere or sold it to a fence, there was a chance he'd head to the warehouse in Barrie to pick up a second load. If he got there before Reynolds, several hours before Reynolds was due to show up, then maybe he could stop this little crime spree at just 2 loads. Sure, it was a long shot, but Mark had to do something to stop this guy. Mark reached Barrie before noon. The Peel Regional Police had notified their counterparts in Barrie about what was going on, but Mark didn't see any marked cars in the lot.
They must be keeping a low profile so as not to scare him off.
Mark found an empty spot between 2 cars in the employee's parking lot and made himself comfortable. If Reynolds was early again, he wouldn't be by for at least another hour, and when he arrived, Mark would be ready for him. Mark waited for over 2 hours, but there was no sign of Randy Reynolds and Motherlode. The guy was either late or had been early. Mark didn't really want to go into the warehouse and find out which it was, but he had no other choice.
Yeah.
It's me, Bud.
What's up?
They found the Motherlode.
Is she all right?
I don't know, but they did tell me where they found it.
Where?
It's in an industrial park at the south end of Brock Road in Pickering.
Pickering?
Yeah, it's on the east side of Toronto.
Yeah, I know where it is.
Mark's surprise was not over the truck being abandoned in Pickering, but that it wound up in Durham region involving yet another police force.
They want you over there to take a look at the truck.
I'm on my way.
Mark first saw Motherlode from about a half a kilometer away. All the wheels were on it, it didn't look too banged up in any way, and all the windows were intact.
So far, so good.
Mark headed over to Motherlode. The driver's side door was unlocked, which saved Mark the trouble of crawling under the truck to retrieve the spare he had tucked away in a magnetic box behind the oil filter. Mark hesitated opening the door a moment, not sure if he wanted to know what the inside of the truck looked like, but he had to open the door sooner or later, and it might as well be sooner.
Oh, God, no.
It was an absolute mess. There were candy wrappers and melted bits of chocolate all over the carpet. There were several empty coffee cups and pop cans lying around, too, some of them not entirely empty. One can of Coke was still dripping onto the floor, creating a big black stain on the light gray carpet. Then the smell finally hit him. It smelled like urine.
Damn it!
Mark had heard of delivery men sometimes taking a leak in the back of their trucks because they had nowhere else to go. But doing it in the cab, that was just wrong. Mark held a hand over his nose and continued to rummage through the cab, checking the storage flaps on the doors.
Son of a bitch!
The guy had taken everything of value. He'd even taken Mark's stash of Canadian Tire money, which after his last visit to the store amounted to about 35 cents.
Un-goddamn believable.
And if that wasn't bad enough, the bastard had even taken Mark's Blue Jay ticket for next week's game against the Yankees.
You stupid bastard.
Mark wouldn't be attending the game, but there was still a good chance someone else might use his ticket. Mark looked forward to finding out if Randy Reynolds was a big baseball fan. It took a bit of convincing to get the Toronto police to accompany Mark to the Blue Jay game. When he'd first called them and explained the situation, he hadn't known his ticket number, so looking for Randy Reynolds in the crowd of people in the area near first base would have been a big waste of time and resources. Luckily, the trucker he bought the ticket from was a season ticket holder, or at least the company he worked for had season tickets, and he'd been able to get the ticket's exact section, aisle, and seat number. Section 116, Row 4, Seat 5. Prior to the game, the police discussed how they might approach whoever sat in the seat and decided not to apprehend anyone in the stands during the course of the game. Instead, the police would have the person in the seat come to them.
And now for the game day Blue Jay giveaway! We'll be first in 5, Row 4, Section 116.
Mark had staked himself out at the Jays merchandise booth on the 100th level and pretended to be sizing baseball caps when a large but attractive woman appeared with ticket in hand looking for anyone affiliated with the Blue Jays to help her claim her prize.
What did I win?
An officer decked out in full Blue Jays regalia stepped forward.
We need you to come to the business office to collect it.
That good, huh?
Oh, yeah. That good.
The officer, along with stadium security and someone from the Blue Jays' front office, escorted the woman away. Mark followed. When Mark reached the office, he was led into a room where he could listen to the woman being interrogated by police through an opening in a sliding window that adjoined the two rooms. Another officer joined Mark in the room.
I assume that her name isn't Randy Reynolds.
That's right.
Any idea who she is?
Maybe it's his girlfriend. I don't know.
The officer nodded, and the two of them listened in on the interrogation underway in the other room.
What's your name?
Mary Milstead.
So, she is his girlfriend.
Uh-huh. Enjoying the game?
Jay's pitching sucks.
We're curious where that ticket of yours came from.
It was issued by the Toronto Blue Jays Baseball Club.
I mean, how did it come to be in your hands?
A friend at work gave it to me.
Where do you work? Can we have that person's name?
Oh, no. That was last game. This game, I bought it from a scalper out in front of the stadium.
Someone gave it to you or you bought it from a scalper. Which is it?
Scalper.
You remember what he looked like? You remember how much you paid?
Too much, I can tell you that.
You know anyone by the name Randy Reynolds?
Am I getting a prize pack or what?
Randy Reynolds. Name ring any bells?
Isn't he a third baseman?
No, he's the trucker who might have stolen that ticket you have in your hand.
Wow. You mean he stole it, then sold it to a scalper, and then that scalper sold it to me?
The police didn't have an answer for that, but they did start asking questions all over again.
Where'd you get the ticket?
Mark wondered what the score in the game was. They held her in the office until the bottom of the eighth inning. It was obvious to everyone she was lying, but she was doing it well, well enough that the police couldn't arrest her or even detain her any longer. When they did let her go, the Blue Jays staff gave her a prize pack, which included tickets to another game, as a gesture of goodwill.
And who says crime doesn't pay?
But as much as he hated to see the woman walk, Mark knew that the police were powerless against her, for now. They'd keep their eye on her, perhaps put out a warrant for Randy Reynolds, and in time, the law would catch up with both of them. It was inevitable. But that didn't do anything to soothe Mark's need for justice now, justice today. And so he decided to administer a little of his own brand of justice, which in the end would be sweeter than anything that could be dished out by the courts. Mark hurried out of the office, picked up an empty drink cup from a nearby garbage container, and made sure his and Mary's path would cross before she left the stadium. He caught up with her at the 200th level.
Mary, is that you?
Mary looked around and saw him approaching. The look on her face was one of confusion.
It is you, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm Mary. Who the hell are you?
Oh, well, my name's Walton, Dirk Walton.
Mark looked at her strangely.
You mean Randy never mentioned my name?
No.
Oh, that's funny. He talks about you all the time.
Mary then smiled, and Mark had his first chance to take a good look at her features. She was pretty enough, but she looked as if hard living had aged her beyond her years. If Mark had to guess, he'd say mid-40s, even though he knew she'd have to be in the mid-30s to run with the likes of Randy Reynolds. There was a hint of gray at her temples, and her fingers had been yellowed by years of cigarette smoke. Her arms and legs were wiry, but had a look of strength to them. He couldn't picture her using her fists against Reynolds, but he imagined she picked up a frying pan or two in her day. And she looked as if she had a mean streak to her that would explode full-born at a moment's notice. No wonder Randy had been so afraid of the woman.
Oh, he does?
Mary smiled slightly, but instead of it being a warm and comforting smile, her eyes had narrowed and her mouth had cracked open slightly, exposing two rows of jagged brown teeth. And all at once, Mark was afraid of her too. But still, he wasn't going to let that stop him from exacting his revenge on Randy Reynolds, the bastard.
Well, he did in the past, but not so much lately because of, well, you know.
What?
Because you and Randy broke up.
First I heard.
Someone named...
Is it Amber? That bitch.
That's a good name for her. Worst of it is, he says she's already given him the HIV, you know, the HIV.
When?
Oh, just recently. But you know how Randy is. He said he wasn't gonna let that slow him down any.
Mary was turning red with anger and looked as if she wanted to hit something with her new Blue Jay tote bag. Obviously, Mark had struck just the right nerve. Randy Reynolds might be able to hide from the police for a while, but Mary, now that was a whole different story. She'd hook up with him sooner or later, maybe even tonight, and she'd make him pay big time.
Good game, huh?
Oh, that bastard!
Mary didn't answer him. Instead, she spun around on her heel and headed for the exit, not even bothering to return to her seat and find out how the game turned out. As Mark watched her leave, he thought about letting the cops know she was leaving, but decided against it. The police would be checking her, and they'd catch up with them in due course. Eventually, they'd both be punished for their crimes. But until that happened, Mark wanted to give Mary the chance to spend as much time with Randy as possible. She looked mad enough to do some real damage, and that was the sort of justice that suited Mark and Motherlode just fine.
If you enjoyed this Mark Dalton adventure, be sure to check out next month's episode featured on the following action-packed titles. Survivalist number 5, The Web. Destroyer number 117, Deadly Genes. And Outlanders number 13, Shadow Scourge.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, Download That Puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.